The Sons of Saturday podcast is brought to you by our friends at Main Street Pharmacy. Located right on Main Street in Blacksburg, Virginia, Main Street Pharmacy is proudly owned by a Hokie family and has been a partner of this podcast since 2020. MSP offers free delivery, curbside pickup, and vaccinations as well. If you are a student or resident in the Blacksburg area, you can always trust that at Main Street Pharmacy, you are not just a number, you are a neighbor. Everybody, Thursday, April 18th. Please forgive me. I may sound under the weather. I'm on the end of a cold. Now, Tuesday was the worst day because I did take a double dose of NyQuil, assuming that it was DayQuil. Horrible day. Bad, bad day. But that's not what we're here to talk about. I'd like to say that I planned on having this recorded today on the day that the legislation in Virginia has been signed. The NCAA legislation has changed. A lot of different things have happened. And I'm not the person to talk about it. So I brought in a subject matter expert in Olivia Nuss. So quick background, through some of the work that we have done in the past and the work that we continue to do in the NIL space at Virginia Tech, our worlds collided at Student Athlete NIL, which is an agency of record for over 55 schools across the country, from massive schools that you have heard of in the Power Five leagues to schools you may have never heard of ever. And where I sit is working on finding alignment with local or national brands and really helping them create ROI and helping athletes really, really maximize their brand on name, image, and likeness. So we have the legal expert from Sunil, Student Athlete NIL, who is here to talk about it. And before we get into an introduction, we will start with Olivia, you're probably not familiar. We do Hokie haikus at the beginning of every single podcast. So we got one from Pete McGee today. Olivia, help. Guide us through the legalese, name, image, likeness. So Olivia, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you for having me on, Billy Ray. So nice to kind of chat and get to know you outside of work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the first question that I have is, tell us a little bit about your background, when you became interested in this topic, and how you've really grown and evolved in this space.
Yeah, so this is actually a funny one. I always say that I didn't choose sports. Sports chose me. I actually grew up dancing and playing competitive volleyball my whole life. I did not pursue sports in college. I actually danced through college. And I was chosen in my freshman year as an LSU bat girl for the baseball team because I was interested in marketing in undergrad. So my undergrad degree is in marketing and digital advertising. I ended up staying on with LSU Athletics through the majority of my undergrad, either in marketing, graphic design, and then eventually working for Will Wade and Nelson Hernandez at LSU basketball for a bit. I worked on everything from recruiting materials to team materials, but mostly graphic design. I then went to pursue my master's at the LSU Manship School of Mass Communication. I'm a three-time LSU grad, so hang on. This degree was digital advertising and strategic communication. So all the ins and outs of marketing campaigns, digital advertising, how to implement certain campaigns for ROI, all of the things you would need in an NIL space that had not yet formed. So when I got into law school, I actually took a job in NCAA compliance, knowing that it would get me out of having to take four electives for my law school classes. So it actually just fell in my lap that I happened to know the LSU athletics department and it happened to be a perfect fit because I was like, how awesome is this? I can stay in the field that I love and also make a change here and get out of classes. So around 2021, when I was in that NCAA compliance internship, my role quickly shifted to focus on NIL with the Alston case. And so for the next 2 years or so, I worked within NCAA compliance, but also transitioning the LSU Athletics Compliance Office into the NIL space and their current program, which is now NILSU. So I worked under their head of NIL, which is Taylor Jacobs now. She was in compliance role. Now she's NIL totally. But that's kind of how I got into the space. Again, it just kind of fell in my lap. And once I graduated, took the bar, stayed with LSU for a bit and did some consulting work. Jason Belzer picked me up to work for student athlete NIL. And now I'm here.
And your day to day. So what do you do? I know what you do day to day. You solve the problems that nobody has an answer to but you. But what does your day to day look like at Student Athlete NIL?
So for Student Athlete NIL, I am head of legal and business affairs. When we started, we were a company of about five. Now we have obviously grown tenfold. So my day to day truly now involves looking at student athlete agreements for over 55 universities. I've written over 50 million in NIL deals. I also do brand and business advertising agreements and sponsorships. So any of our local, regional, national businesses that want to partner with any of our schools, I'm reviewing and writing those. I do agent negotiations for those with representation. And then I am also doing legal review of documents, NCAA compliance, legal research and readiness in this space to keep us the most up to date we can be for our clients.
So you won't say it, I'll say it. There is not a person in the world that has written more NIL contracts than Olivia. So really, really excited to dive into this. And we're going to really kind of take this apart as if maybe you don't know a lot about it. And then we're going to jump into some of the legislation that came out today. So in its purest form, name, image, and likeness, what is that?
Yeah, so I love this question because you can talk about name, image, and likeness from a college athletic standpoint, but when you take it down to its purest form, it's really simply just the right that every individual has to control the commercial use of their own name, which includes your nicknames, things you might be known by, your image, which is photographs, visual content, social content, and your likeness. So refers that to any characteristics that may be involved in your personal brand, and it's your right to control the commercial use of those. So your key points here within college athletics is going to be that NIL, name, image, and likeness, is if your fundamental right. It's not something created by the NCAA. Obviously, this came about because of the Alston case. And to give you a quick background there, basically, Alston is founded on antitrust principles where education-related benefits for student athletes like scholarships, tutoring, et cetera. The court basically ruled that the NCAA violated antitrust laws by suppressing the athlete's ability to capitalize on commercial use of their name, image, and likeness. And while the case didn't involve directly using their name, image, and likeness, it took away that restriction on education-related benefits and opened the door to allow them to make that money on their use of their NIL. So at its core, I would say it's influencer advertising, right? It's everything we see on TikTok every day of your regular run-of-the-mill college kid going online saying, here's a product I tried, here's what I love about it. It's within college athletics, the ability for an athlete to actually go and sign autographs and get compensated for that after the fact, after a game. It's the ability to make appearance at a kid's birthday party. It's just the freedom to be able to use your NIL in whatever way you want, which was previously prohibited by the NCAA.
I'm so glad that you brought up the term influencer marketing because, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but I feel like NIL has a bad connotation in some spaces because a lot of times people view it as, okay, I am going to give money to this athlete because they're good at sports. That's not necessarily what it is. It really is they're good at sports. So therefore they have more marketability. So therefore it is essentially influencer marketing. And if you really look at it at its core and the problem that, you know, I try to solve day to day is for a lot of local businesses, if you approach them and you say, okay, I want you to work with this athlete. And if you just present it that way, not a lot of local businesses are going to raise their hand and say, sure, I'm willing to do that. But if you really think about it, there aren't that many more notable or influential people at these college campuses than student athletes. And it just has opened the door for businesses to capitalize on that and athletes to capitalize on it. It's not a one-way street.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, the Alston case kind of goes hand in hand with a case that's right before that, which I think is so important, which is the O'Bannon case, which essentially argued exactly this. So Ed O'Bannon basically challenged the NCAA's use of his name, image, and likeness in the video game, right? In NCAA basketball. And basically, his argument is, why am I being restricted from receiving capital or funds just because I'm part of the NCAA? There's no reason that I shouldn't be able to receive money for you guys using my name, image, and likeness so clearly in a video game just because I'm a college athlete. And so it basically puts college athletes on the same playing field as every other college kid, right? Every other college kid who's able to record those videos and get brand endorsements to be an influencer or an advertiser online. That's really what it was created to do at its core.
And what's so funny, is you think about, you know, when I was in college, right? If you walked past the bookstore, you had a fat head of Isaiah Ford outside of the library, and they're using his name, image, and likeness for whatever reason. If somebody looks at the bookstore when you weren't going to look, it's, oh, there's Isaiah making a catch, or there's Justin Robinson, you know, making a layup. And it always did have this weird kind of taste in your mouth of how exactly it was boiling down. So it's just crazy how it's taken so many painful occurrences along the way. You think of the creation of the G League and then sending high school players there, and some of the ways that they tried to curtail the NCAA. But it seems like we're going to talk about this. Just it's all seeming to come together to where we believed it was going to eventually end up. And I think we got a step closer today. So going in on the current landscape of the NCAA and NIL, what is a collective? Like, what exactly is a collective?
Yeah, so what is a collective? They've gone through many iterations since we first defined what they are, but I would say generally they're organizations that were started to facilitate NIL deals for student athletes. Because when the NCAA first released guidance, they said, universities, we don't want you involved in this. If they're going to be paid for their name, image, and likeness, it's going to be independent of the university. And it's going to be with brands or businesses that have nothing to do with you to maintain that separation. So collectives actually stepped in to first create a solution to that facilitation problem. I would say what collectives have evolved into is somewhat of a booster and a fundraiser organization to fund teams based on NIL opportunities. So I always like to wrap it into, okay, they're meeting the needs of the fans because they're handling, okay, we know we want this player. We know he will probably cost X amount, in that kind of NFL mindset. But we are also solving the issue of we are facilitating the deals that have not been able to be facilitated by the university up to this point because they haven't allowed the universities to offer help to any of their athletes in this space.
And I think that brings up a very interesting point. I was talking with my dad a couple of days ago, and he made this point. He says, "I see all these numbers from On3, and whether they're correct or whether they're incorrect, you're telling me that the New England Patriots for basically 15 years had one marketable player on their entire roster, and his name was Tom Brady, right? He's the only person that you saw on television. He's the only person you saw advertising stuff." And that leads to the question of what is the difference between the market value of a student athlete and the roster value of a student athlete? Can you break that down?
Yeah, so I love this question because I think both are important. And in this space, they go hand in hand. I think what you're seeing with a lot of independently run collectives right now is this more of an idea of roster value, which in the long run is not going to build a sustainable model. So I think you can't talk about roster value and market value without talking about organic and synthetic NIL. And these are two terms that are totally made up in my own brain, just to compartmentalize from an advertising standpoint what we're talking about here. So when I say organic NIL, I mean this involves brands and businesses actually creating partnerships with an athlete to leverage the athlete's NIL for marketing purposes. It's going to be a specific marketing purpose, whether that's built on, you know, a mutual interest, campaign objectives, or a particular brand alignment based on that athlete's personality. That's the center of the goal to achieve, right?
JJ McCarthy at the national championship doing the Calm ad, which is one of, if not the best, example of true NIL that I've probably seen over the last 12 months.
Exactly. And even, you know, Caitlin Clark with the State Farm commercial, again, achieving a specific brand objective. They see her numbers. They see how she rolls. They like her brand alignment. They like her objectives. And that was exposure for them. Now, synthetic NIL on the other side is this more transactional booster and fan piece where collectives or boosters are seeking to compensate athletes for specific deliverables that they buy from them, focusing on supporting the athlete and allowing them to receive funds rather than strict marketing goals like companies, brands are going to be searching for. So it's really important for businesses and collectives to be able to maintain the ability to leverage both in order to build a sustainable model. I think you're seeing a lot of collectives lean on that synthetic NIL and lean on a lot of boosters to continue to fund their operations. And it's a very small percentage of people compared to what they could be reaching.
I'm so glad you brought that up. And this is such a buzzword that is thrown around on Slack and our internal meetings a lot. And it's fans and brands. And if you realize, before we break those two things down, I think collectives as a whole, the biggest problem that they need to solve is the across the country is going to the same 5, 8, 12, or 20 same donors every single time. And you're asking them to put the roster. You're not going to get any tax benefit, which will change over the course of the next 12, however many months on a state to state basis. But really the challenge that they're trying to solve for is how can we as a collective create a meaningful membership platform that moves the needle, where I've always made this reference. There are the 24/7s of the world. There are the Rivals of the world. There are all of these sites that are very tightly wound with your fandom of these different schools. I am going to go on this message board. I am going to say our wide receiver is awesome. Our offensive coordinator sucks. Our pitching coach needs to be replaced. But I'm going to also give $8.99, $10.99, $15.99 every single month. And that money is not going to make the team any better. So all of the collectives are really trying to solve for that equation. So fans and brands really are the two buckets that you need to help offset that booster mentality from the same 10 to 15 people.
Yep, absolutely. And like I said, you need to be able to leverage both the brands and the fans simultaneously to support the student athletes and really make a collective a unique business operation. So on the brand side, like I said, this is more that organic NIL. Collectives are buying assets from student athletes. And this is what we do at Student Athlete NIL. This is not to say, and I can positively say, independently run collectives probably don't have the infrastructure that we do with the amount of employees and the internal processes we've set up. But essentially what we do is on the brand side, we buy assets from the student athletes that we have on retainer. And that pot is refilled by brand activations and partnerships that we go and resell with local, regional, national businesses. So this creates that partnership with an athlete from partnerships that leverage their NIL based on those campaign objectives. And we are able to do that because we've already pre-bought those assets from the student athletes. Now, why are we pre-buying assets? Well, that goes into the fans bucket, right? We are pre-buying assets and putting these athletes on retainer because there has been a need to pay this athlete. And so we are filling the need to pay the athlete while simultaneously growing their brand from a partnerships perspective. So basically the athlete is identified, the collective buys the assets from that student athlete. And basically this fills the need for the fans and the boosters on that side in order to compensate the athlete for whatever they feel that athlete deserves, right? So these work hand in hand. You have the assets, you can go out and actually create that organic NIL the way that it was meant to be. And on the fan side, you have to provide value, right? So we're not just asking, hey, give us $15 a month. We're saying, hey, come in where you can. We're opening this up to a larger floor of membership rather than that top 10 to 15% of donors who are already fatigued. They're probably already giving to the university for facilities or elsewhere, we're saying, hey, come in, we're going to meet you where you are, and we're going to provide you with specific ways to re-engage with these student athletes on a personal level. And by doing that, we're re-engaging a fan base of people that may not be involved in that donor world, but now feel like they're a part of something. You're building a sustainable revenue stream for NIL that doesn't compete with their alumni association or their facility use, right? And it's fostering a deeper connection with your fans so they feel like they're actually a part of the team. They're getting more exposure and they're getting straight connection with those student athletes and with the rest of the fan base.
It's really interesting. I know we talked about the 24/7 and Rivals model before, but the model of, and this is just kind of to recap what you just said, essentially student athletes agree to be put on essentially a salary that is then sold into over the course of their career. So it's not very different from what an MMR partner does at a school. If a Learfield or a Playfly or one of these larger companies, they buy the right to use, let's say Oklahoma or USC's game day or their logo. And then their job is to go ahead and sell the rights out to other vendors over the course of a year. So great stuff there. And then from the brand partnership side, just some references of things that have been really, really interesting in the Sunil universe. I don't know which ones jump out to you, but at the University of Oklahoma, they've worked with Onnit on trading cards, actually selling trading cards in different gas stations and different convenience stores across Norman and across the greater state of Oklahoma, working with student athletes there, which has been really cool. Our GM over at Syracuse has implemented a really, really cool on-court shoot-around where you can bring your kids down, you can bring whoever you'd like down, and they're able to take a couple of free throws after every single game. That generates a pot. You have some sponsors on top of there. You make two of your free throws, you're leaving with a free sandwich. And then lastly, we've seen a lot of collectives do this. Sons of Saturday actually just launched a beer at Bull and Bones. Check it out, the Saturday Shandy. But branding beer and branding vodka that has to do with the NIL collectives, whether it be a collectible that you hang up on your wall or something that you're bringing out to your game day. There are some really, really unique ways that you can monetize the fan base. And that's going to be different for everywhere. That's not going to be the same at Cal as it is at St. John's. It's not going to be the same at Florida as it is for Washington. You really have to find a way to tap in. But to say that there isn't a market for it, there absolutely is, because it exists currently in avenues that don't overall uplift the programs. It uplifts CBS, or it uplifts Paramount, or it uplifts whatever umbrella company owns these message boards or whatever else.
Yeah. So, and actually that was the deal that I was really going to touch on. Obviously everything you're talking about is incorporating those fans directly to engage with a bigger community of people who are passionate about seeing our athletes succeed, which I think is so wonderful. I think those are equally as important as opportunities for larger brands who maybe are a little tense about getting into the NIL space. They're maybe unsure about resting their entire brand on one or two athletes. You know, they're still 18 to 22 year old kids, but we did a giant campaign for CBS where CBS came to us and said, we need to promote Survivor this season. And we're going to do it in a Gen Z way. We're going to have a filter on TikTok and on Instagram, and we're going to get these Gen Zers involved using our filter, and that's going to promote our season, which you have to grab their attention and meet them where they are, right? CBS was a larger company that came in with that advertising objective and recognized that need. And we were able, because of the scale that we have, to provide athletes from all over the country that fit their criteria from a number standpoint. So number of followers, number of impressions, things of that nature. We were able to actually set it up as a national campaign so that we had kids at every single one of our schools using the filter, promoting Survivor. And it was actually a huge success for the company.
I think that also speaks to kind of, as this all becomes consolidated, because that's ultimately where it's headed. And we've benefited as a company from having all of these schools under a single contract, under a single agreement, where if a Snickers wanted to go out, or if a Skittles wanted to go out, or any company along those lines wanted to get involved, you're talking about multiple different agreements, multiple different NDAs, multiple different contracts just to work with one athlete or a handful of athletes. So, no, absolutely. And not to mention some of these larger companies, it may be viewed as a huge risk for them to tie their brand to a singular athlete.
One person. Yep. Yeah.
Teenagers, 20-year-olds happen to make mistakes or do crazy things. And the ability to really diversify that risk and diversify your message across different markets is absolutely huge for these larger companies. When you're looking to go get one of those larger companies to jump on board, it's going to be hard to do it without kind of being able to do it all at once and blanket the country or blanket the entire continent. So,
yeah. And so the advantage is volume in college athletics mm-hmm. right now. I think, and this is one of the misconceptions that really grinds my gears online, is that it's one or two student athletes benefiting from NIL. They're getting millions of dollars here for this endorsement. That's generally not the reality. The reality is most student athletes have to work to build their brands. But if you as a company can identify that they have group value and you can go out and resell that to a national business, well, then there's less risk for the business that there's one spotlight that they're throwing all their NIL money in. And for the team, everybody benefits. So it's a great solution overall.
So the million-dollar legislation question, I'm wearing my State of Virginia shirt today. This is where I shut up. What happened in Virginia today? I do want to give a huge shout out to Aaron Rouse, former Virginia Tech football player who was paramount in making this happen. But that legislation was signed today. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what it means for not only the state of Virginia and the Virginia schools, but also the entire NCAA?
Yes. So first of all, I'm barred in Louisiana. This is in no way legal advice. This is just my interpretation based off of reading the legislation and obviously what's happening with the NCAA. This is going to go hand in hand with what the NCAA chooses to enforce and what they choose not to enforce. But let's start with what does it mean? So the new law allows colleges and universities within the state of Virginia to directly compensate student athletes for NIL opportunities. So previously, athletes could only profit from NIL through external deals, like I explained before. This is still the case from a direct payment situation for most of the rest of the country, because the NCAA has a delineation of what it means to facilitate a deal and what it means to pay a student athlete directly. So paying student athletes directly per the NCAA is still a no-go, right? In Virginia, the law is they are allowed to directly compensate athletes in a situation where, let's say, the school wants them to show up for an appearance after a game and sign autographs. The school can do that. They can compensate them. So the law explicitly states that athletes are not considered employees by their schools. So the schools in Virginia are still not allowed to pay athletes for performance-based, performance in general, but performance-based opportunities, aka pay for play, right? And so how does this change the current landscape? It is very uncertain right now. And expanding opportunities for athletes is really the core of this, so that athletes can now explore opportunities directly with their university, dependent upon the university going against NCAA rules right now. So if the NCAA doesn't change the rules before July, when this goes into effect, and a school decides to sign an NIL deal with one of the athletes in the state of Virginia, let's say the NCAA decides to enforce that rule and says, school, you absolutely cannot pay them directly. The state would probably sue the NCAA, as we've seen before. They're fighting several lawsuits right now. And if the association decides to penalize the school, they'll probably end up right in the same chair where they've always been, fighting an antitrust lawsuit. And so it's really dependent on the athletic administration to decide, is this something we want to jump into without NCAA permission and ask forgiveness? Or is this something that we really want a decision on from the NCAA before we try to implement this within the state?
So sounds like a pretty aggressive version of a staring contest, is what it really sounds like. Now, the last question that falls under this is really, what does this mean for collectives? And my longstanding opinion on this is there has been this conception that, okay, everything goes in-house, it's fine, it's taken care of. There are so many more issues that need to be taken care of in terms of infrastructure, in terms of Title IX ramifications, in terms of the relationships with the brands that takes place. But the biggest thing that I see is that just basically means you're moving the debt that comes with supporting your roster. If that's $5 million, if that's $20 million, that is then another line item on the university's budget that they have to take care of. So in your opinion, what does it mean for collectives when all of this goes in-house, whether it be state by state or sweeping across the nation?
Yeah, so first, let me say I've worked in an athletic department. I know the pace that an athletic department moves at. I know the pace that a public university moves at. So from my perspective, schools are going to continue to utilize collectives because most universities don't have the infrastructure to achieve something like this. Collectives might adapt maybe by focusing on smaller schools with limited resources as opposed to the giants. For example, LSU probably has the resources to implement something like this. But at the schools and at the majority of schools where they don't, collaboration is going to be really important with your collective, and your collective better have top functioning process, top functioning ability to payment process, to send out those 1099s when they need to be sent out, to hold the athlete's hand through all of the deliverables that they're supposed to achieve. So I would say structure and function over ability to facilitate directly. So talking about structure and function, one of the main issues that comes up here is Title IX. So obviously, the federal law prohibits sex-based discrimination in education programs and activities that receive federal funds. So when you're talking about Title IX, it requires that schools provide equal opportunity for men and women to participate in sports on campus in a college athletics context. So while Title IX specifically requires that schools spend an equal amount of money or a proportional amount of money on scholarships for men and women, we don't have an answer on whether that is going to be implemented in an NIL standpoint, right? Because I think the hardest thing about NIL is, again, whether you're talking about organic or synthetic NIL, if you are directing funds to men's basketball from the collective merely to get those kids on retainer, that's very different than facilitating a deal for a female athlete who wants to work with Dunkin' Donuts and Dunkin' has approached you about that opportunity with an athlete, right? Because that's real brand value that you can't control. I think the key words here is university involvement. And so what you're going to see is that schools are probably going to need to ensure that any NIL opportunities that are facilitated are equitably managed for both females and males from a synthetic NIL standpoint. Otherwise, it'll open up Title IX suits.
Because again, the $12 million, $15 million, $17 million question is, you're not going to fill that gap by asking people to add $250 to their season ticket or $300 to their season ticket. You're still going to need to create, number one, those brand opportunities that come along and facilitate those to happen, not just hand raisers. And then number two, you really need to capitalize on the opportunity to create membership driven, fan driven monetization opportunities. Those are some huge words, but you're going to still continue to need to do that because at the end of the day, that is a shortfall that has to be accounted for.
Yeah. And so let's just think about the positions that you would have to fill to keep track of all of that from a resources standpoint, right? You're talking about transparency. So they're going to have to set clear policies and procedures around NIL involvement to ensure fairness and avoid, you know, improprietary allocations when it comes to these donors' money. You have to fill a compliance role for NCAA, assuming they're going to keep, you know, implementing new rules and guidance. And then you're also going to have to fill the roles of essentially what we do right now is account executive, making sure these athletes know what their obligations are and making sure they fulfill it. You're going to need accounting. You're going to need an entire accounting staff to make sure that they are getting their tax paperwork, that they're filing their taxes on time, that they're doing everything they need to do in order to receive those payments. So short term, I don't see universities having the infrastructure to do this, perhaps long term. But I think the best way is to keep a degree of separation and have a partner like a Learfield or like Sunil to step in and facilitate all of that for you.
So I'm going to lob one more over the fence. I know it just came out today, probably not a ton of time to spend on it, but what do they call it? They call it guidance. The NCAA has this word that they use when they just issue, they send out this really long book that somebody has to read, that somebody is typically you. But what is it exactly that came out today? It seemed almost as if it was in response to what happened in Virginia today.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So actually in January, the NCAA came out with their proposed changes to rules. And they said, we're going to be voting on this. If we vote on it and it goes through, it's going to go into effect August 1. Coincidentally, and maybe not coincidentally, they actually had a vote that was prioritized around adopting the proposal that allows schools to provide assistance and support, aka that facilitation piece, with name, image, and likeness activities for student athletes who disclose agreements. So that's the caveat there, right? They need to be dialed in to exactly what's going on. So the council's action isn't final until the council meets and concludes Thursday, which they did today. And they basically ratified the Division I Board of Directors, stating that schools can facilitate deals. So under the new rule, member schools are going to be able to increase NIL-related support, is what they've said. Between student athletes and third parties. I think that a lot of people are frustrated that we haven't seen any definition or any clarification around what facilitation or NIL-related support actually means and where that line is going to be drawn, because that's really where the enforcement comes in here. So they basically have issued a couple of different provisions around this, one of them being any deal over $600 has to be disclosed to the university. That has been a standard from the beginning. So NCAA does require complete transparency. They encourage student athletes to disclose all deals before they participate. Whether that happens or not, usually it's after participation. It just depends. There hasn't been clear guidelines, rules, specifications for how this should be implemented at every university. So every university has kind of taken a different route. I know some universities even perform social media checks to see if their athletes haven't reported anything that they should know about. Whether they're going to continue to leave that in place in the future is going to be an interesting conversation.
So I have a Billy Ray question here, because I saw this on the guidance that came out from the NCAA. And my question is, from what I understand, universities across the country have come up with this way where they can get an athlete, essentially, where they may not have a scholarship spot, but they will find a way to have NIL basically essentially pay for that scholarship. But this change is not allowed to be redirected into offsetting any school funds, whether that be scholarship, books, cost of attendance. Like, those are two completely separate pots. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Because there is, so the NCAA has been very adamant on maintaining the difference between student athlete NIL participation and university funds. So again, I think that's the reason for the delineation between facilitation and direct payment, like it's quoted in the new legislation out of Virginia, because we know that's where the clear line is. Like, they don't really want the schools to become the payment processor at the end of the day and be directly paying, but they want to be able to allow staff to assist in finding deals for athletes. And I think that's a lot of the frustration from the university level is, I have all of these businesses or local brands or, you know, local burger shops who are contacting me being like, can you put me in touch with X athlete We love her brand. We want to work with her. We really would like to just like give her a free meal. And right now they're not able to do that. They just have to say, they literally just have to say, reach out to her, DM her, hope she answers. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And so the delineation here is that they're allowing that next step of, okay, you can give the burger place her phone number and or put her on an email chain with that company and actually help her facilitate this process where, you know, a lot of these athletes are brand new at this and they go, well, what am I supposed to say? Like, what do I say when they reach out? What am I supposed to value myself at? You know? And so I think at a university level, this is really going to change in a good way, because it's going to allow your NIL programs to really build relationships with athletes while also providing guidance and support where it makes sense. And so I think that's where we are right now. And it'll be interesting to see if the NCAA, well, if Virginia implements what's written in their law and the NCAA decides to enforce.
Hey guys, this is Ollie Jennings III, wide receiver for your Virginia Tech Hokies. When I committed to Virginia Tech football, I committed to the best. That's why I chose Harvey's GM in Radford. Why settle for less when you can have the best? Go to Harvey's GM for all of your vehicle needs. Tell them Ollie sent you. That's Harvey's GM, Tyler Ave in Radford, or go to their website at harveysgm.com for more info.
So, wow. Incredible rundown. Appreciate that. We're going to flip the page over to rapid fire before getting into some of our fan submitted questions. The first one, I know you're excited to answer. What is the biggest misconception surrounding NIL?
Yeah, so I think I said it in the beginning, but I think many people, you wouldn't believe the negative attitude that so many people have when I tell them I work in this space simply because of the headlines. And I don't know how much more I can scream this, but don't believe the headlines. Most of them are exaggerated and most of them are wrong. I would say that the ones that are dialed in on three, ESPN for the most part, you know, some of these bigger, more well-known conglomerates have their finger on the pulse. For anyone who says that this is the wild, wild west, I beg of you, please retire that phrase. Yes, it's chaos right now. However, the reason all of these things are happening simultaneously is so that somebody can put their foot down at some point and say, we have policies in place for this and we know how to execute them. So whenever we get to a point, whether it's the NCAA or whether it's federal legislation, we are going to have guidance and it is coming and you're seeing it come out now. And the NCAA's hand is going to be forced either by federal legislation or by these court decisions that we've been talking about. So it's going to come down to how we get there, not necessarily if we're going to, because we will.
Look, I think it's really interesting because change for most people is painful. But it's a change that has been far, far, far overdue. And my criticism of, you know, I said on three earlier, and regardless of how dialed in or not dialed in they are, you're vilifying the athlete and you're vilifying right. the medium by putting out these gaudy, gaudy numbers. And it's unfortunate that that's been the result, because it's been so funny how there's been a heel turn from student athletes are taken advantage of to student athletes are spoiled brats. It happened like that. And I think that plays a huge part in it.
So, and, you know, my argument to that is nobody batted an eye or turned a head when the universities challenged the NCAA on TV rights, right? That just happened 1980s, 1985, 84. And so it's like, okay, if the universities can do it and we've been vilifying the universities, why not allow the student athletes to engage in that pot, right? Like, you have kids putting their lives on the line.
That's a great point.
But like, you have kids putting their bodies on the line every single day in a world where traditionally you signed away your rights immediately when you became an NCAA athlete and you weren't allowed to make zip. You got your scholarship if you were lucky. You got educational benefits somewhere. But I mean, this is the largest redistribution of wealth in college athletics that we have ever seen, to quote our CEO, Jason Belzer. And it is super important that everyone take a step back and realize that eventually this is going to evolve into a much better, much more equitable division of assets than we've had in the past.
So what is your favorite story or result stemming from NIL? I mean, selfishly, working with the Queens of Castle has been so, so tremendous at Virginia Tech. And I referenced JJ McCarthy. You saw Caitlin Clark, what she did with State Farm, and she had Jake from State Farm at the NBA draft, which was pretty funny. But do you have a personal favorite story or occurrence or activation that sticks out to you?
So I loved, and I have to say, it's a bit sad. I kind of feel like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain a lot of the time because I'm doing the paperwork and I'm not doing the day-to-day interactions with our athletes. But I got to get involved when I took the job with Sunil. We were starting a Steve Madden campaign for female athletes. And because I had just left LSU, I was actually able to connect our account manager with the LSU, NILSU staff, which is their NIL staff there. And I was able to see girls that I had onboarded from a compliance perspective or had given presentations to about NIL. I got to go in and say, give these girls a chance. They know what they're doing and they have influencer potential like you've never seen. And so we actually had a couple of girls that I recommended get picked, not just from LSU, but from elsewhere. And to be able to see their confidence grow throughout that campaign and getting used to creating that content and getting comfortable on camera, that's a huge step. And it's something that a lot of athletes really don't have the charisma for unless you work at it. And so it's really cool to be able to see the development of confidence in these individual athletes and how comfortable they're really getting being themselves, promoting themselves, knowing their worth. So I would say overall, that's my biggest.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you went back in time and you listened to Pat Finn and I on a podcast 3 years ago, it's completely different than what it is now. I'm not saying I'm great, but I was definitely horrible back then. And I think that's kind of another unrecognized benefit of NIL is not only are you learning how to be comfortable in front of a camera, knowing how to be comfortable dealing with brands, but at the same standpoint, it instills a lot of those lessons that college athletics instills in you in if you want to get paid as if you were working at any other job, you have to take care of what you need to take care of. You have to take care of your taxes. You have to show up on time. You have to be on top of your business. And if you're not, you're not going to maximize your potential. And other than that, you got to seek out opportunities. The athletes who are most successful in the NIL space are not just athletes who are the most successful on or off the court or field. They're the men or the women that seek out opportunities and put themselves out there. And those are the most successful stories you always hear.
100%.
So this question comes from Sam Jesse, and I'm kind of in the middle on this. What is the barrier for players being employees of universities? So first and foremost, you can't really just throw employees out there, because that comes with pensions, that comes with health insurance, that comes with liability from the school. So then you look at the contracted side of it, but what does that look like? What are the barriers and what do you think a timeline is on that, if it's even realistic?
Yeah, so this is a really popular question. And I think, you know, like I've said before, it's either going to be federal legislation or it's going to be court decisions. Timelines with court decisions are obviously a lot longer than we would have a situation where the federal government intercedes and we have legislation. So if it's the courts, for example, the Dartmouth case, obviously they have voted to unionize. Dartmouth can still appeal to federal court, and that could take years, right? It could take years before we get a final decision. Now, federal legislation-wise, Senator Ted Cruz has actually created legislation that gives student athletes a safe harbor, where the proposed legislation would allow student athletes to not be classified as employees simply because of participation in their sport. And I think that could save us a lot of time here if the federal government could actually make a decision and move forward. That I'm not confident with, but I think that ultimately employment would complicate a lot, and it would take away a lot of opportunities from, say, Olympic and women's sports.
So we're going to move into letters from the lunch pail here. So Pete McGee, what are foreign players able to do in the NIL space, and can it still be lucrative for them?
Yeah, so this is a tough question, because anytime you're talking about international athletes, there is always an associated risk because they do not have the same rights as American citizens, right?
Which is crazy. Just...
Yeah. So, well, they're on F1 visas, most of them. Right. There are other types of visas based on either special ability or, you know, there are work visas. But for the most part, when you're talking about international student athletes, they're on F1 visas. And because of F1 visa restrictions, there are limitations about what athletes can do for work, right? Active income generation is considered work and can violate visa terms and lead to visa denial or deportation. So when you're talking about international athletes, the biggest concept we wanna talk about here is when they go in for consular review, so review of their current visa status, or they're applying maybe for an extension. But the doctrine of non-reviewability allows a consular the discretion to deny or permit the visa application to move forward for any reason or no reason at all. Basically, their decisions are not appealable or reviewable, meaning that you can participate in NIL as an international athlete, but there is always going to be an inherent risk that if you push that envelope too far, that consular can say, this looks interesting. This looks like you actually participated in work, in active work, as opposed to passive income. And therefore, I'm denying the status, right? And so that leads to deportation and a lot of other issues that I think many people are being a little too aggressive with. And so limiting the scope is really the focus here. So the focus is on passive activities outside of the U.S., that would, be potential NIL opportunities that could generate a passive income. So, for example, one of the things we've implemented at Student Athlete NIL is we will actually advertise, we'll purchase the rights to the name, image, and likeness of the international student athlete and advertise abroad on billboards because they don't have to do anything for that, right? They provide a pre-existing photo and it goes, you know, somewhere in France on a billboard where it's advertised to their community. But again, everything comes with a risk. So that doctrine of non-reviewability really makes it to where it's a risk no matter what you have these athletes do. So that is the caution that I would say with international athletes. Can it be lucrative? Yeah, it can be based on their brand value. Because again, they can't go and sign autographs. They cannot post on social media, because even if you have them post while they're home, that consular doesn't have to look at where the post was posted from, right? They don't have to entertain evidence that they were actually abroad when that photo was taken. They could have been sitting in their living room in Texas. So there's always a risk when you're talking about having an international student athlete actively participate in anything.
Which is so crazy because, I mean, we've seen it in either schools we've operated in or schools outside where you can follow every single direction that is given. You can make sure that when a student athlete is playing in some tournament that is not in the United States, they're going ahead and performing the deliverables that basically they're getting guidance, not just from the collective, but from whether it be the school, whether it be from the NCAA. And then you have zero insight as to how that is going to pan out a month from now or 6 months from now. So
yeah. And it's so true. And actually, it's interesting because today I read an article about bipartisan legislation on at a federal level coming out and being introduced around changing those laws around F1 visas to have international athletes be able to participate in NIL, which could be a complication. I am not the international law specialist. If you have a lot of interest around this topic, sports visa law on Twitter. Ksenia is amazing. She is an absolute beast when it comes to anything visa or international law. So I suggest you give her a follow. She's really the expert in this space.
Next question. Do you foresee any requirements coming down the line for NIL collectives to publish audited financial statements? Now, I saw this in the NCAA legislation as well, that it said, I'm interested to know if this is being sold as information, but it said that the NCAA is going to have access for trends and reporting on financial transactions between schools and student athletes. Now, I would assume that that information is probably going to be proprietary. We're not going to see the NCAA tweeting out graphics with this, but I would assume somebody is going to pay for that data. That would be my assumption.
Yeah, so this is interesting because the NCAA, within their new rules that they're implementing, one of the things that they're implementing is a voluntary platform that providers can opt into and basically get a rating based on how much experience they have in the NIL space. So they will have like a designated list of providers. And they will also have information and data around the deals that are being disclosed, which is the reason for that requirement of NIL deals must be disclosed to compliance, right? And every university has a compliance office. That's what it's run through. But essentially, I don't know that they would publicize it as they say that it's going to be transparent and it's going to be used transparently to promote the well-being and equity of college athletics and NIL. Again, that's very vague. We don't really know what that means, and we don't really know how that's going to be implemented. But to your specific requirement of, you know, reporting in general, I don't know, unless it's at a university level and it's being enforced at a university level, I would say from a legal standpoint, I don't see why they should be required to disclose, other than the fact that it's been said by the NCAA and they're going to enforce it. Because if you think about it, that would be like asking me or you, if we got the Steve Madden deal as Billy Ray or Olivia, to report to some higher authority that, hey, we're participating in an influencer advertising deal. Just thought you should know.
Right.
Like, right. What's the real reason for that? And I think it's a little patronizing to athletes to say, we need to make sure that we have all of your deals so that we make sure you know what you're doing and that you're doing it, right?
And again, if that data ends up in the wrong person's hands, again, you get in a position where I don't want anybody counting my pockets, unless you're, I don't want the government counting my pockets, but they're going to. I don't need some other group having that data. But again, you just have to wait to see how it all kind of shakes out. It's steps in the right direction. It's just the rate at which those steps are being taken.
Yeah. And as of now, the NCAA doesn't mandate audited financial statements for collectives. But it seems like certainly for the 501c3 collectives now, the IRS has obviously indicated that many of those collectives won't qualify for tax exempt status. So I'm sure they're going to take a harder look at those. But I don't think otherwise, outside of the NCAA, we're going to see that.
So we have been playing geographical hopscotch. We started in Virginia. We jumped to Texas. We jumped overseas. And now we're jumping to Oregon. So the last question that I have for you is, what do you expect the result from the recent Oregon NIL law that just passed, reportedly allows pay to be tied to playing? Man, it's some word salad. Pay to play. They're looking for pay to play.
So I think the answer is somewhat the same as what we've already covered, in that is the NCAA going to continue to try to enforce their rules? It's really difficult to predict because it comes down to whether or not Oregon is going to continue to follow NCAA rules and maintain their status within the Big Ten conference, right? If they want to be part of that conference, they have to follow NCAA rules. The situation's going to hinge basically on legal challenges when the school takes action to compensate a player based on performance. And at that point, is the NCAA going to try to enforce its policies? Or maybe it won't because of the other legal challenges it's facing, and they've kind of rolled back on others. But it'll probably likely be another antitrust suit. So, like others, could result in a TRO or a preliminary injunction.
Olivia, last couple questions for you. The best bar in Baton Rouge?
Okay. For the kiddos, the 18 to 22s, I would say Fred's. It's an absolute college staple, and it's where I lived most of my senior year. I would say if you're looking for something more adult in Baton Rouge, it's going to be the Rev, which is right on campus. It's an easy walk right from your dorm room out of your bed all the way over to the bar and back to your bed again. So I would say those are my two personal faves.
A lot of guitars on the wall. Favorite person to listen to? What is on your Spotify playlist, Olivia?
Oh my gosh, this one's so hard. So I am actually a huge John Mayer fan. The two guitars behind me, though, this one's signed by Les Paul.
Okay.
And this one is signed by Toby Keith back here. Okay. So those are two favorites as well, raised mostly on the music of my dad. But yeah.
We need to get John Mayer in there to sign the third guitar is what really needs
right?
to happen.
Right? I'm actually trying to get him to play for my wedding, truth be told. I'm going to send him an RSVP.
We have to ask him what his name, image, and likeness is, and we can find out. Olivia, yeah. this was super informative. I really, really appreciate it. And I wanted to give you an opportunity. So where can people find information? I know every single time legislation comes out, you have an opinion. You make sure to amplify that. Where can people listen to you? Where can people read your stuff? Where can people find you?
Yeah, so my personal Twitter is usually where I blast out a lot of information. I try to keep it as middle of the road as possible to give you information and not my personal opinion. So it's at O-N-U-S-S with an underscore. And then my personal podcast with one of my former coworkers from LSU Athletics, he's currently the head of NIL at Cincinnati, is The Disclosure. On Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you find your podcasts. And it's by Eddie Taylor and Olivia Ness.
We will be sure to link that in the article that goes out. But Olivia, thank you so much. We probably will call you back for another visit as all of this news rolls out. But really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Billy Ray.
See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Time to wander, tripping in the sand. We smoke out windows, drink till we can't stand. But I saw you dance like you want to in my head. And all that she said is, oh, I know just what you're thinking.